From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court released a unanimous decision that said that Colorado could not keep former President Donald Trump off of that state's primary ballot. In the meantime, the court has not yet ruled on a case that will decide if Trump has immunity for any of his actions on January 6, 2021. Dr. David Adler studies constitutional law and has been watching the cases against Trump very closely. He is the president of the Alturas Institute, and he's hosting another of his constitutional conversations this Thursday at Boise State's Yonkey Center. We are getting a sneak peek of that, though, because he is joining us now to talk about both of these cases. Dr. Adler, it is always nice to have you on the program.
Thank you, Jim. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with yesterday's decision. Can you break this down for us? Because what did the court say about state's ability to put Trump on the primary ballot? And as I mentioned, Dr. Adler, this was a unanimous decision by the court.
You know, Gemma, it was a unanimous decision, 9-0, the result being that the court overturned the Colorado Supreme Court decision that would have excluded Donald Trump from the Colorado ballot. And the bottom line here is the Supreme Court, all nine justices agreed that, in fact, one state could not exclude a presidential candidate from the ballot. In fact, a little more specifically, states may not exclude candidates for federal office. And so that's the 9-0 ruling. But when we break this down, as you suggest, it looks more like a 5-4 decision, Gemma, because four of the justices write concurring opinions that almost read like dissents, in which they take the majority to task for overreaching, accusing the majority of deciding more than that needed deciding in this particular case. And that grates on the three liberal justices particularly, but also Justice Amy Coney Barrett, the conservative, because it's been a tried and true rule for the Supreme Court for at least a century and almost stretching back to the founding period, that the court should not overreach, that it should not decide more than it's being asked to decide. And if we ask, well, what was that point of contention all about? Mm-hmm. It's precisely that the majority decided that the only way that that Donald Trump or any other federal officer might be excluded under Section 3, 14th Amendment, it's in fact because Congress would have the responsibility to pass a law spelling out exactly which kinds of officers could be disqualified, what the process would be, and writing very particular legislation. And that caused a lot of concern for Justices Sotomayor and Kagan and Jackson, and to some extent Barrett, who believed that all that was necessary to decide in the case, as I say, was whether or not the state could exclude Donald Trump from the ballot.
So is that where the overreach, at least what these what three of the justices in their opinion were saying is that that was the overreach, Dr. Adler?
That's right. That's what the overreach was. First of all, concurring opinions did not agree that the only way to exclude somebody from the ballot under Section 3 was if Congress passed a statute. And indeed, the text of Section 3 says nothing about that. So that's an exercise in overreach. Secondly, by holding that Congress alone could exclude somebody through the enactment of legislation, might preclude a federal prosecutor from winning a case in court, holding that indeed somebody had engaged in insurrection and therefore is barred from serving in office. So that's overreach. And there's a host of other problems. But the three justices who joined in a concurrence believe that, in fact, the court was now engaged in yet another exercise in judicial activism, assuming powers that it does not enjoy for the purpose of reaching conclusions that serve its own interests. ends, its own desired results. And the three justices, Kagan, Sotomayor, and Jackson Brown were, I think, Brown Jackson, excuse me, I think were recalling that in the Dobbs case, that Chief Justice Roberts had said that the court should not decide anything more than is necessary to be decided. And those justices threw it back at him at the very outset of their opinion, forming something of a bookend, because they closed their concurring opinion by quoting former Justice Stephen Breyer, who wrote a dissenting opinion in Bush versus Gore, when he said what the court did today should have been left undone. That led Justice Barrett to write a pretty sharp retort to those justices, accusing them of stridency. She thought it better to lower the temperature rather than to raise it at this delicate moment in American history. And you can only imagine that Kagan and the others probably were asking themselves to, and might have said to Barrett, you're talking stridency. Wait a minute. You were one of the members of the majority that overturned Roe versus Wade and denied women their reproductive rights. That's stridency. So, Gemma, this is not a surprise, given the nature of oral argument that we saw several weeks ago, but isn't it revealing about the behind-the-scenes sniping and quarreling that have been characterizing this court now for more than 2 or 3 years?
Well, I do think it does definitely. I mean, we knew there was division, right? And so this does show, you know, more division. But at the same time, I think, Dr. Adler, you can also argue, though, that, yes, I mean, we can go back and look at what Justice Coney Barrett, how she ruled with Roe versus Wade. However, you know, you look at this and you're like, okay, well, she actually, in a separate opinion, faulted the five other justices for going further to specify that Section 3 can be enforced only through federal legislation. And we all know that there's such profound partisan divisions in Congress, that's probably not going to happen. And so I'm curious, because then, you know, you get to this point where Coney Barrett writes, and I'm quoting, particularly in this circumstance, writings on the court should turn the national temperature down, not up. Well, there can be arguments made about many decisions that have made on the court recently about turning the temperature up.
Well, you're exactly right, Gemma. And here, Coney Barrett is essentially taking both sides to task, the majority for overreaching, which she thinks is a violation of an old rule within the court. And secondly, to, as you point out, to take the other concurring justices to task for raising the temperature. I think that what we want to remember, as you nicely point out, is that given the fact that the majority has said that only Congress could write legislation to preclude somebody from serving under Section 3, recalls that this dysfunctional Congress, which can barely do anything, is not about to write such legislation. And that's why I think some critics of this decision are going to say that what the majority really did here was to tilt the field in favor of Donald Trump by insulating him and to some degree the court from further efforts, perhaps, to corral him. So
Dr. Adler, can I interrupt for just a minute, though, because I want to talk about you know, the criticism of this opinion, but kind of on the flip side of that is that, but if the court had ruled against Donald Trump, I think it's fair to say, well, you know, there could come a time where there is someone else, maybe not a Republican, maybe not someone who is as divisive as Donald Trump, where states say, well, we just don't want them on the ballot. And I mean, I think that we can even look back all the way to FDR when we put term limits in place for presidents. And then when Reagan was in office, the Republicans who put term limits in place on FDR wanted to repeal all of that. So should we maybe potentially be looking at history and almost saying, like, what's good for the goose is good for the gander? I mean, you can't have it both ways.
Yeah, I take your point. You think your point is well made. Well, two thoughts here. First of all, it is the case that it's possible that there could always be retribution. We would like to think that our system provides a lot of protections against a willy-nilly exercise in retribution. You got our guy, we're going to get yours kind of thing. And we have to believe, we hope, that there is some integrity in the process, and there are prosecutors that can check that kind of retribution, and of course, courts that can check the retribution. That's point one. Point two is that what we're looking at here is a period in time in which the temperature is very, very high. Barrett is certainly correct about that. And one of our concerns that you and I have discussed before is how we turn down that temperature. And that's where I think we look for the court to exert some leadership. And in this case, if the court had simply confined itself to the issue before it, to which all nine agreed, was that a state could not preclude a presidential candidate from the ballot, then it would have turned down the temperature. But as Barrett herself pointed out, by virtue of the overreach, the majority essentially left the other four justices with a question of what path to take.
So, Dr. Adler, I only have about 5 minutes left, but I want to get to this other case before the Supreme Court. Can you quickly sum it up for folks who may not know the issue involved with former President Trump?
So this is the immunity case. President Trump has claimed absolute immunity from criminal prosecution. The federal district court ruled against him. The DC Circuit Court of Appeals ruled against him, and now he appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. And we're waiting to see what the court will do. After sitting on this case for an overly long period of time, it finally announced a week or so ago that it will hear the case. But it's not going to hear oral argument until the week of April 22nd, which is actually the final week when the court hears oral arguments. And this long delay means that there may not be any trial for Donald Trump on the charges brought against him by Special Prosecutor Jack Smith involving the insurrection on January 6, 2021. And this is taking a toll on America because I think many Americans believe that they ought to know before they go to the polls in November whether or not the president is guilty of these charges or not. And so there are a number of things that this court might do after it hears oral argument, Gemma. It might decide the case on the merits. Indeed, it could decide it very quickly, as in other landmark cases, the Supreme Court rendered rulings very, very quickly. Or it may send the case back to the federal district judge with orders to consider what kinds of official acts performed by the president might be worthy of immunity from prosecution. And the reason why that question arises is because the nature of the order presented by the court when it said we will hear oral argument at the end of April is essentially asking whether and under what circumstances a president in the performance of his official duties might be immune from criminal prosecution. And thus that the court has opened the door to the possibility that there are circumstances in which presidential actions might invite criminal prosecution and therefore perhaps necessitate immunity. And certainly that's Donald Trump's argument. So the concerning part here for me certainly is that the court's action may so delay these legal proceedings that we may never get a trial before the election in November. And then, of course, if we don't get a trial before the election and Donald Trump should win a second term, he would have these charges dismissed against him, meaning we'll never be able to hold President Trump accountable or perhaps provide him with the opportunity to clear himself of all these many charges against him. It might be a case, Gemma, again, where the old aphorism, justice delayed is justice denied, might well be the headlines in America's newspapers And our system is built on accountability of all governmental officers. That's what James Madison and the framers had in mind when they wrote the Constitution, that all governmental officials are accountable both to the rule of law and the American people. In this case, there may not be any accountability for Donald Trump.
Well, as always, Dr. Adley, we Dr. Adler, we so appreciate your time and your expertise on this. As we said, Dr. Adler, who is the president of the Alturas Institute, will be holding his next constitutional conversation. As I mentioned, it's titled "Torn from the Headlines: When the Courts Fail the Rule of Law." It is set for this Thursday, 4 p.m. at Boise State University's Yonkey Center. Dr. Adler, we really, really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me, Gemma.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.